Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. It's Wednesday night, it's 9 o'clock. Welcome to Self-Defense 101. I'm DJ Daniel Sun, and I have two guests in the studio with me here. Brian Helmley is an organizer in San Jose, California with the IWW, and Paul Ortiz, a professor up at UC Santa Cruz. Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
All right, thanks for having us.
Wonderful. Tonight we're going to be talking a little bit about the upcoming anniversary of the IWW, the 100th anniversary, as well as the Real Work Film Festival that begins this Sunday with a screening of The Yes Man at the Nick. And we'll be talking with a filmmaker who made a film that will be shown as well. And so please stay tuned to Self-Defense 101, and we'll be with you just shortly.
Willow roses grow wild over me when I've gone off to the land it is to be. In the stillness of my heart, when my soul and body part, willow roses grow wild, roses grow wild, will them roses grow wild over me.
Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're listening to some songs from the IWW. The Real Work Film Festival is in its fourth year, is focused a little bit on the Wobblies and the IWW because it's the 100th anniversary of the formation of the union. How has that kind of Wobbly mentality influenced the film festival this year?
Well, it's really influenced us, Danielson. It's influenced us to try to recapture the sense of activism and struggle in the labor movement, and you know, to try to capture that spirit that we created just last week with the strike at UCSC, where two unions went out on strike. AFSCME went out on strike. The clerical workers didn't have to go out on strike, but they went out in solidarity. The students didn't have to go down there. They were there. Community people didn't have to go there. But we created something, I think, on that picket line, and the fact that people were brave enough to take a risk to commit acts of civil disobedience in support of the strike, to sit down in the road, to do something that was not sanctioned, and the fact that they were able to shut down business as usual, I think that, you know, Brother Brian, I think, would probably agree with me, that personifies the spirit of what the industrial workers of the world have been all about. And we're really honored at the Real Work Labor Film Festival this year to be able to pay homage to the 100th anniversary of the formation of really the most important union in U.S. history, but not just in history, in a union which continues to thrive and to grow. And so that's going to be a big part of this year's Real Work May Day Labor Film Festival. One of the events which we're really excited about is there's a film that's in the making. It's by a remarkable filmmaker from the Evergreen State College, Anne Fischel. And she is finishing a film, and it's titled Lewis County Hope and Struggle. And I believe that she's just about to join us, but I wanted to say just a few things about Anne and this work. And this is a really important film because it tells the history of the Centralia Massacre. And the Centralia Massacre is really one of the most infamous events in U.S. labor history. It was a situation where the industrial workers of the world, which was this union primarily of immigrants, of poor people, of unemployed, timber workers, farm workers, started organizing in the Pacific Northwest, in this case in Centralia, Washington, which was this really kind of hardscrabble timber town. They organized a very vibrant union, and the American Legion and the Chamber of Commerce in Centralia tried to take them out. And what happened was that the hall, the Wobblies Union Hall, was attacked by the American Legion and the Chamber of Commerce folks. There were several people who were killed. One of the lead activists of the IWW was actually lynched after that event. And so Anne Fischel in Lewis County Hope and Struggle has captured that moment in U.S. labor history, which many people have tried to sweep under the rug. If you read a mainstream history textbook, you will not find that event, the Centralia Massacre. So It's a very important film, and Anne Fischel is doing a very important service, I think, by doing the film.
With that introduction, I'd like to welcome Anne to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you for bringing me on.
Wonderful. So this is, film is described as a work in progress. Where are you at in the process right now?
Well, I began this film in 1997 when a committee was in Centralia was starting to produce a mural to commemorate this history. And so I've been working on this film for a while. I'm hoping that I'm almost completed with it, but I'm still kind of finishing up, I guess that's what I'd say.
What drove you to start on the project specifically?
I'm relatively new to the Northwest. I'm originally from the Northeast of the country, and a lot of my documentary film work in the past has been rooted in community issues. So I have a fairly deep and driving need to learn about the region in which I live. And in 1997, I was invited to document the work of this committee as they began to put together a program for producing this mural. And it was an opportunity for me to learn more about the history of the region, more about what community people are close to me were thinking about and struggling with today. So it was just an opportunity, and I really jumped at it. I worked very closely with the committee, and I documented their organizing efforts and the making of the mural. And then I had to kind of step back and think about what I needed to learn in order to really do justice to this community and to this topic. And so I ended up spending, over a series of summers, a lot of time in archives trying to really understand better the history. And then went back out into the community again and tried to look at what was going on in Lewis County today and why people were looking back to this moment in 1919 and wanting to reopen those issues and finding them significant and trying to work with them in the present, and then went ahead with the process of completing the film. This film has been shown in Centralia, where the massacre occurred. The people who are in the film have seen it.
You're listening to Self-Defense 101 on Free Radio Santa Cruz. My guests are Anne Fischel, Paul Ortiz, and Brian Helmley. Tonight's discussion is about the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, and the state of the labor movement in the U.S.
The Centralia massacre culminated with the death of four American Legionnaires who were killed in the attack on the Union Hall. And then an IWW organizer named Nathan Wesley Everest was taken out and lynched. And Wesley Everest is known as one of the great IWW martyrs. He also really needs to be remembered as an organizer. He was 32 years old when he died, and he had been orphaned when he was about 12. And he had spent many of his teenage years and all of his adult years working in the woods and really struggling for economic democracy and better working conditions for working people. So, and then several months after the massacre occurred in early 1920, 11 IWW members and supporters were put on trial for the murder of one of, and accused of the death of one of the American Legionnaires, a man named Warren Grimm. Of those 11, 8 were convicted, and they spent 25 to 40, they were convicted and sentenced to 25 to 40 years in prison. No one was ever tried or convicted of the murder of Nathan Wesley Everest. And the lynching which occurred, I mean, I think we have to understand that lynching in 1919 was a very public act. There were many, many people who participated. Their names and faces were known. They were prominent members of the community. It would not have been difficult to bring them to account if people had been willing to speak up. But the community was afraid. And I think the fact that IWW members could be sentenced and convicted on what was essentially a trumped-up charge, but that Wesley Everett's death went unrecognized and that there was no justice, there was no act of justice to follow his death, really taught the community that organizing was not safe. And so people were actively discouraged from organizing, and people were discouraged from talking about it. In 1922, there was a statue that was constructed in a public park in downtown Centralia, very prominently sited. and it's often known as the Sentinel or the World War I statue. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. But if you read along the base, what it contains are the faces of the four legionnaires and their names, and then a text which says that they died in the streets of Centralia while on peaceful parade, wearing the uniforms of the country that they had proudly served. So at that point, one version of this history became official history in the community. And all other versions of that history, anything that had to do with organizing, with struggling for social justice, with defending a union hall which was part home, part community center for people, and all the things that it stood for, were really repressed and silenced. So there were some modest attempts over the years to kind of open this up to public discussion. In the 1950s, I've heard of incidents of high school students in Centralia and community college students in Centralia trying to write research papers about the Centralia massacre. And what I've been told, that in all cases their papers were confiscated, and they were told that the papers would not be circulated. One person was given an F, another person was given an A. But the actual research and the discussion that might have come out of the research, once again, were repressed and discouraged. And then in the early 1980s, a student in Centralia High School won a contest to design a monument. And the monument she actually wanted to design was simply an acknowledgement of the fact that the IWW had had a presence in Centralia in 1919. She'd heard a little bit about this. She wanted to commemorate it. She designed a little marker. There was a huge debate in the city council, and they eventually decided to permit her to do this, and so she did. That kind of opened a small door. And then in 1997, this committee that I worked with decided to go ahead and open up the topic again and really invite discussion and controversy and debate and an honest kind of airing of the issues that labor confronted in 1919 and the issues that labor confronts today in Lewis County. And so people felt that they were taking on something that was controversial, that was potentially not safe. We're not sure of the reception they would receive. So, you know, that's some of the controversy.
It sounds like this film has really been part of a dialogue and a healing process then for this community.
Well, I hope so. I don't think the committee that I worked with had a sense of how their efforts would be received. But the mural actually faces the statue head-on in downtown Centralia. And when it was completed, the local newspaper, which has been in the community since the early 20th century and had a lot to do with inflaming passions against the IWW in 1919, came out with an editorial and said that they felt that it was fair and reasonable for labor to tell the other side of the story. So whether people are making decisions about what was actually factually true, I think there is an acknowledgement that the experiences of working people have to be reintegrated back into the history, and that's and to our story about what the community is, and that's valuable.
Yeah, I think, Anne, the work that you're doing is really what we're trying to promote in the Real Work Labor Film Festival. And Paul Buell actually told us first about your work, and we were so excited about it because we'd had, you and I actually have some mutual friends in the labor movement up in the Northwest. I didn't know this until quite recently, but people like Helen Lee, who had been working up there.
Yes.
At the Evergreen Labor Center, have been been working on the mural project. And I mean, the work that you're doing is so critical because I was up in Lewis County, when I was a grad student early in the 1990s, and I can remember going to the library there and talking to a couple of the older librarians, and they told me very similar stories. They told me that they had been instructed, or their predecessors in the library had been instructed, to literally physically destroy evidence of the massacre so that when people would come in, would bring in papers or diaries or other types of written records, the library would just destroy it so that, you know, by the time I think you started doing your research, I mean, a lot of people doing the research on the Wobblies had to go to the state archive.
Uh-huh.
You know, because, and that's actually one of the things I find so moving about your film. what you've done in the film is you've given us, along with commemorating the event, you use that testimony of the Wobblies in prison to an incredible effect. I mean, you hear the voice, you can hear the voices of these men who are in this incredibly, you know, they've been framed up unjustly, they're in prison, but there's still this sense of resistance and rebellion.
Well, I really appreciate your saying that. I think it's when I began to work in the archives and I stumbled on some of that testimony. And, you know, it's essentially mugshots and statements that were taken as people were admitted to the penitentiary to serve their terms. I mean, it's a lot of stuff like that. That when you're holding that material in your hands, all of a sudden people come alive for you in a different way. And I think we're often taught history is something that's, it's abstract, it happened to somebody else, it doesn't actually, we don't perceive its effect on us. I think it began to dawn on me and to the members of this committee that produced this mural that we were walking down the same straight streets that these struggling men and women had walked down. And all of a sudden we were beginning to understand how they had seen their situation, what they were fighting for, what they cared about, what mattered to them. So there's a whole sense of urgency that I think I began to develop around this as these struggling men and women of the IWW became, as I became intimate with them through this research. And if that comes through in the film, I'm really glad.
Another question I had for you, Anne, about this, as the mural really took shape and, you know, it really sent these cultural shockwaves across the country because, you know, in some ways the Centralia Massacre had almost become a story that was a kind of, you know, it was almost this privileged kind of secret. If you were a radical, if you were like a left labor person, you knew about the Centralia Massacre. But really, the story had been kept on, you know, the lid had been so tight for so many years. But the mural, in many ways, takes the lid off of this really terrible suppression of history.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen, in your assessment, has that mural and this renewed conversation about the Centralia Massacre, I mean, how has that impacted, you know, people in labor, in Lewis County and the area, you know, community activists, people such as that? Has it had an impact?
You know, as a documentary filmmaker, I think I was taught always to want a sense of a kind of a closure to any work that I make. And it would be great to be able to tell you that there's been this complete transformation
right.
of the consciousness of the community following the completion of this mural. I can't say that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do perceive is that it's opened up some room. It's opened up a space. And it's a space where people can begin to think clearly and critically about their situation. They can make connections between 1919 and today. They can say things about their situation today that perhaps they wouldn't have felt able to say before. They can insist on the centrality and the primacy of labor in the community. They can insist that their voices be heard. And they can rediscover the value of collective action. I think we often, you know, those of us who work with unions kind of agonize over what's happening to the union movement in this country. And I think there's a clear sense that in 1919, when people were immersed in really life and death struggles for dignity and for decent working conditions, but also for a vision of possibility for working people, that there was a vitality and an energy to this movement, which was a highly democratic movement. And so if we reconnect to that and recapture that in some way, maybe it's something people can begin to reinstill in their own collective organizing and their own collective work in their communities. And I hope that some of that is happening in Lewis County. The other thing is that there's Lewis County, like any community that's been largely has owed its livelihood to resource extraction, has both industrial sectors and agricultural sectors. And in 1919, farmers and workers in Lewis County were very closely connected. That hasn't necessarily been the case, you know, and since the latter half of the 20th century. But in my exploration in Lewis County, I think it became very clear that as farmers are looking at the industrialization of agriculture and looking at the end of small family farms, and as workers are seeing themselves made increasingly expendable because of neoliberal policies and globalization and basically the exportation of jobs and industry, I think people have new ground for solidarity. And I have heard some discussions after showings of the film in Lewis County that seem to suggest that opened up some awareness there. So, you know, we'll see. It's a process.
My name is Brian Helmley. I'm an organizer out here in Santa Cruz with the IWW.
Hi, Brian.
Hello. I really have to thank you for putting together a film that allows people to see exactly what was happening in 1919. And I really have to agree with you about your assessment, like, of what's going on with globalization and the way that the economy is being restructured so fast and in so many ways that we have absolutely no control over here on the ground. And I think you're right. I think that is, it's sort of putting the lie to the notion that you can get a contract as workers, that you can get a contract and have it enforced by the government and have that make you safe, because the government can't regulate trade. It's basically said, we're not going to regulate trade. We're going to hand it over to the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank, and we're going to privatize everything, and it's just out of our hands. And so when it goes out of the hands of the government, which in 1935 with the Wagner Act, they said, well, you have a right to a union, and people flooded into the AFL-CIO so fast, or the AFL so fast, that they didn't even know what to do with the workers. They created federated locals. There were so many people trying to join unions. It was this moment when fear broke, the fear that had been instilled by actions like the vigilantes in Centralia and, you know, the people that shipped the coal miners out of the coal fields in Colorado out to Bisbee, Arizona, I believe. And, you know, the crimes that were committed against labor during that period were done to do exactly what you said just a minute ago, and of shutting down and quashing a democratic radical labor movement that had legs, that could run, that it didn't require big organizations to regulate them. They just were doing it spontaneously all over the place.
I should tell you, Brian, and I you know, just as a caution, that there was some IWW participation in the making of this mural, but there's also, and I think the third part of the film really reflects that, there's a tension that develops between people who are residents of the community and IWW folks who are coming in from outside. And so my own local branch of the IWW has seen this film, and we've had some discussion about it. And I hope the way I've crafted this is, I think it's acceptable to them, and so I hope it will be acceptable to other contemporary IWW members. I mean no disrespect.
Oh, of course not.
But I think we still all have a lot to learn about how to do this work in community settings.
You know, you both mentioned the contrast between the AFL-CIO and the traditional union structure and the philosophy and structure of the Wobblies. And I just want to play a quick clip of Paul Buell speaking earlier about that contrast, and we'll rejoin the conversation.
Because it was the very opposite of the American Federation of Labor, or as they used to call it, the American Separation of Labor. The AFL was founded on the basis of craft separation and craft loyalty, so that when one craft would go out on a strike, the other crafts working in the same place felt perfectly comfortable about going to work normally through a picket line, because after all, they didn't belong to that particular craft. So the AFL was based upon the aristocracy of labor. White males only were allowed to be members, and membership demanded a very high initiation fee. And membership was generally handed down from father to son or uncle to nephew, much like the building trades until very recent times. The principle was to keep as many people out as possible and thereby to raise the price of labor. It was bitterly anti-immigrant, as well as it was anti-black and anti-female and so on and so forth. and was based upon a principle of authoritarian bureaucracy, although there was a different mood in many of the shops and places of work at the bottom level, and a few of the unions, like the brewery workers, who joined a truly international union that stretched from Germany to the U.S., and people held one membership card and all of it, actually had industrial unions. That is to say, everyone in the same place of business belonged to the same union, went out on the strike together, and felt like they were one group. Only they and the United Mine Workers had what you would call industrial unions or comprehensive unions, and were within the AFL.
Paul Buell on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 and freakradio.org. We're speaking on the phone with Anne Fischel, documentary filmmaker, and in the studio we have Brian and Paul Ortiz, professor, author, and organizer locally in Santa Cruz. And can you contrast the Wobbly philosophy again with what Paul has just said about the AFL and the traditional organizing structure of the union?
My understanding is that the IWW had a really unique approach to organizing early in the 20th century, and, you know, in many ways still does today. They organized what were considered to be unskilled workers when the AFL did not. They organized people across job categories, so they created solidarity between people who didn't necessarily do exactly the same kind of work. They organized across languages. They worked with immigrants. They worked with people of different ethnicities. They worked with people of different races. They were actively anti-racist. They emphasized economic democracy and collective grassroots decision-making. And they were really creative and inventive about using multiple communication systems. So they, you know, music, cartoons, graphics, newspapers, posters. I mean, they really had a multi-leveled and quite pervasive and creative communication structure going, which I think has been a model for many of us for organizing for many, many years. They also had a really different sense of what the relationship between labor and capital would be, should be. And so there's someone in my film who says, speaking as a worker to other workers, "We are the ones who produce all wealth, and we have a right to what we produce." So the notion would be that workers are absolutely central to the production process, that they produce everything, that that a wage is not enough that people shouldn't simply aspire to collect a wage, that a true economic democracy would mean that, you know, that we divided the fruits of labor equally.
You know, the world that we live in today, Brian was talking earlier about globalization, and in many ways, the world we live in today, our understanding of economics, our understanding of relationships between workers and bosses, between corporate firms, shareholders, and the government, in many ways, it's kind of, from a Wobbly perspective in 1919, our understanding now is kind of an upside-down understanding of the way the world works. Because according to core IWW doctrines, it's labor that is the source of all wealth. It's not capital, it's not shareholders, it's not investors, it's ordinary working people. And I think that's part of the key into the Wobbly kind of, you know, philosophy and culture. It isn't something that they invented. It's something that they very much drew from these great wellsprings of radicalism in Latin America, in Europe, in the United States. The sense, I mean, even as recent as good old Abraham Lincoln, Lincoln said that labor precedes capital and is superior, in fact, to capital. If you can imagine George Bush saying the same thing, it would be pretty extraordinary. But it's, yeah, I mean, and they, as you're saying too, I think their cultural approach, I mean, the fact that they used cartoons, the fact that they had to communicate in multiple languages, and the fact that they saw labor struggle not as just something that happens in the workplace, but that they carried it out into soapboxes. And our very notions, in fact, of free speech, you know, the rights of free speech, in large part owe, at least partially, to the fact that you had people in IWW who would literally set up soapboxes in these very tough towns like Spokane, Washington, Eastern Washington, you know, 1910. A wobbly organizer would set up a soapbox downtown Spokane, get up on that soapbox and start talking about the rights of working people. You know, and all hell would break loose, right? The police would come down, the Chamber of Commerce would come down, and they would get, these wobblies would get beaten up, they'd get thrown in jail, they would get out of jail, and they would set up the soapbox again. And we owe a lot to them.
Brian Helmley is working with the wobblies here locally in Santa Cruz.
I think people can kind of feel entitled to have free speech right now. I think people do feel entitled to have that, and I'm really glad. But it's very limited, and it's surprising to watch what happens when a cop walks by at a demonstration, or when your boss walks by at work, or when someone with authority to really mess up your life comes anywhere near you. Your speech definitely will change. Mine certainly does. I'm very anti-authoritarian, but I definitely have learned to moderate my behavior to suit the institutional demands of the society, and you really get in trouble. I mean, homeless people experience this all the time, and I think what has struck me about when I've read about sort of the free speech fights was how it really was hobos and kind of homeless, poor, really destitute people rolling into town to go to these things, because they were workers who had been displaced. They were, so like right now we deal with a lot of flexibilization. Workers are supposed to be flexible. We're supposed to accept part-time, half-time, you know, multiple jobs, and just kind of really be thankful to have jobs. And the fact is that that was the same mentality that was going on back in the early part of the 20th century, was that workers were really, really exploited and forced into situations where they had to accept serious degradation as part of their lives and couldn't plan anything. So these people were contingent labor, just like temps now. And when there was a fight, they would get word through this elaborate system of communication like you guys have been, or you folks have been describing, that the IWW had, thankfully, and they would all come to town, and they would set up soapboxes, and they would commit direct action over and over and over and over until they won, and they had nothing to lose, and that's why they were able to do it. These were people that were so poor that they could do this and had to do this in order to survive, and I think the survival strategies that workers are coming up with right now is what I'm looking to find out what kind of interesting direct actions, or, you know, like satyagraha, as Gandhi called it, things that you can do that really express what you need to survive and have great moral authority in doing it.
Do you think we may also be at a time that's similar to 1919 in the sense that the very economic structure of society, what it can offer us, I mean, what hopes we can have for it, you know, whether we're really going down the right, that's really open to question right now. There was a flat-out challenge to capitalism in 1919. And I think in the post-war period, that really dropped away. It hasn't been possible to really challenge that. And I don't think workers have been particularly interested in challenging it, as you mentioned, Brian, really since the New Deal, since the 1930s. And yet we seem to be moving into a whole different kind of landscape right now, as those kinds of rights that people won dropped away. I mean, there's someone in my film who says 1919 is coming back at us. Do you think that may raise some of the same questions that people struggled over in 1919?
I think so, and I think that, and it really comes up with a couple of other films along with your film that we're showing in the film festival. One of them, I think you might be familiar with Naomi Klein's new film, The Take.
Uh-huh.
On what's happening in the Argentinian economy. And of course, you know, as we all know, the Argentinian economy became prisoner to, I mean, the worst forms of neoliberalism, privatization, you know, structural adjustment, total downsizing of the social, you know, educational structure in order to satisfy outside investors. And they essentially pulled the plug in 2002. The economy collapsed, and There was a shaking out period of time where people were kind of in a daze, trying to figure out what had happened to them. You know, they were victims. And after a period of years, what the film shows is groups of workers who kind of reorganize themselves, go back to their workplaces, factories, you know, sewing rooms, all sorts of different types of businesses. And they began setting up cooperative structures amongst themselves and running these factories and these businesses in many cases, much more efficiently than the CEOs had run them, right, under a straight capitalist system. Now, that's not happening everywhere in the world, but I think it's happening in more and more places. I mean, I see it just in my kind of limited neck of the woods here in Santa Cruz, but I also saw it when I taught at Duke University. Over time, in the 90s, I saw something really changing. And what was changing was that in the mid to kind of late 90s, my students were telling me that, okay, we're in a new economy. It's the high-tech economy. It's what they used to call the bottomless economy, where the internet and the World Wide Web were going to make, you know, this incredibly new system, which wouldn't have any more recessions, which wouldn't have any more depressions, which was going to lift all of the, you know, developing economies in the world up, right? We laugh at it now, but a lot of people believed in that. I mean, how many people really believe in that now? I see more and more young people and middle-aged and older folks who, like the person in your film, are saying, we're headed, I mean, they might not say, you know, we're headed back towards 1919, but I hear a lot of people more willing to question the system. Now, of course, as we all know, that can go in a few different directions.
Yeah.
It can go into a direction of cynicism and inaction, or it could go into a direction of direct action. And we just saw it here at UCSC with the recent strike we had. I mean, the UC administration took a very hard line. Since I've been here, it's been very difficult. I've seen very few unions successfully negotiate with the University of California. It's one of the largest corporations in the state. And the fact that you had these two unions going out and adopting new kinds of tactics, incredible community support beyond what I've ever seen. And, you know, in Santa Cruz, we like to believe we're a progressive community, but on labor issues and economic issues, we're weak. Housing issues, we are really weak. So the fact that so many people came out to this strike, many more people than came out at our strike 2 years ago that Q had called and the teachers union, I'm seeing that as part, you know, kind of part of evidence all over the world that people are shaking things up a little bit now. And we're hoping to use the film festival as a place to create these spaces for, you know, for us ordinary folk, to talk about these things that we read about in the New York Times, that we see, you know, people like Andy Stern, the head of the SEIU, saying, you know, this is what the shape of the future of the labor movement should be. But we don't get to participate in those debates. So we're hoping to use the film festival to open spaces where we can participate in those debates.
And I guess I'd like to add that, I would say that we are experiencing things probably that would resonate with people. Like if there were people who were alive now that were alive then and politically conscious, they would be saying very similar things to what, you know, you're talking about. And I think what we're discussing here, because everybody is running up against this pretty universally. There aren't very many industries that are protected from the downsizing and the sort of ruthless economic violence that is, everyone is starting to experience. No, there's less cushion to the exploitation. The middle class is shrinking, and that means that there are fewer people who are willing to sort of just tolerate however bad it gets in terms of political freedom or, civil liberties, that as long as they've got their job and their, you know, middle class lifestyle, they'll be okay, and they will support whatever government provides that for them. I think that that's starting to drop away, which is fortunate. And I guess I would, you know, when you were discussing the violence of the repression, I was thinking of the way that, you know, in 1886, the violent putting down of the Haymarket, protests to get the 8-hour day, the general strike that occurred to get the 8-hour day, there were huge, huge amounts of violence. And prior to that, even in 1877, there was a great uprising that followed the railroads across the country and shut down the entire country's railroad system, which would be like shutting down the highway system now. And there was enormous violence, and the state militia was called out all across the country. And that's the reason that there are large forts in the middle of most big cities, is that after 1877, the federal government put out huge amounts of energy and money to build forts to prevent civil unrest. Civil unrest being unions, basically. That was the fear. And, you know, the fear broke when people started to see that it was possible to organize and that they were going to be able to do better than they thought they had. I think the Wagner Act was sort of a false It was wonderful in that it was finally legal to get a union, and everybody knew that, and the president supported it, and we were coming out of a depression, or they wanted to come out of a depression. But I think that the promise was very false, because it was mediated by the government rather than just saying, we will defend the rights of workers to do whatever they have to do to survive and improve their lot. The government said, you can jump through these hoops, get union recognition that we will recognize, and then we will enforce that contract that you write with your boss. We will enforce that and force the boss to do it, or else we will take away their corporate charter. Although I don't think they even said that. They just said that they would lay penalties on the corporation. Nowadays, when governments lay penalties on a corporation, they can be sued under NAFTA. They can have, you know, fines put on them. They can have retaliatory trade sanctions from the WTO. You know, anything like that is very frowned upon by governments. So they are literally unable to even issue the offer to workers now. They can't even say, I will protect you from the market. They can't say that. And I think that's huge. I think that means that we have to take it into our own hands in ways. And when we put the labor in to organize our communities and our workplaces, we should have control over the organizations that we form. And I think that that's something that people are starting to get very savvy about when they see that there is any hint of racism, sexism, you know, dogmatic ideological stuff like I might be spouting right now, things like that. They tend to just walk away and they won't participate because they see it as illegitimate, and they don't have to participate in things that they see as illegitimate. And that's a part of free speech that I hope people hold on to, but I really hope they organize too. So.
Well, and it may be that folks in the so-called third world will be our teachers now. You know, as Paul was talking about, you know, the amazing occupation of the factories that's shown in the take.
And one of the things I think that's remarkable about that film, you know, and you mentioned, I love this imagery of, people in the so-called third world now becoming our teachers, because I think that's very much true. I think that for years, people in the World Bank and the IMF, and these are institutions really directed and controlled from the U.S. and Europe, for years the assumption was we were going to teach the poor black people or the poor brown people how to run their economies.
Right.
And, you know, right, and 50 years later, I mean, everyone, we realize it just doesn't work. And so now it's almost as the shoe, it's almost like the shoe's on the other foot. But one of the things I like about this, what I think is really a newer generation of what I call activist documentary film work, and I put your film and Naomi Klein's film in that same bracket, is what y'all show is you don't show us these static events that happen one time and then they're over. What you show us in Lewis County Hope and Struggle is a process, a change over time that occurs in people who are trying to come to grips with their history, right? What Naomi Klein shows us in The Take is a group of workers who don't start out. I mean, some of them start out, you know, kind of radical. Some of them are members of the Socialist Workers Party in South America, but most of them are not. I mean, most of them are just unemployed. They're out of work. They're broke. They're like, you know, the people in the soapboxes in Spokane in 1910. They don't apparently have much to lose. But what these films show is that over a period of time, working cooperatively, they get themselves together. At the beginning of that film, The Take, I mean, the notion that any of these men and women are going to take over their factories is very dubious. But you see them as they begin to meet together, their self-confidence begins to increase. They have a lot of arguments. They're not all solid. They have huge disagreements. But they find a way, using the knowledge they have of production, of whatever it is, if it's sewing, if it's putting machine parts together, if it's welding or whatever, they use that as a basis. And the community support is quite remarkable. And I think that could be a big difference in Argentina, that there's been incredible community support for the factory kind of reoccupation movement. Whereas, of course, I mean, you're up in Centralia, and the community is a lot more, kind of ambivalent about kind of commemorating the Wobblies.
Paulo Ortiz is a professor at University of California, Santa Cruz in the Department of Community Studies, and Fischel teaches at Evergreen State College in Washington.
I have to say this is based on a discussion I had with my own students, because I teach at the Evergreen State College, and I'm working with a student group that's actually making a film about local resistance to the Patriot Act. And I think this is going to be a very fine piece of work, and they're really struggling with how to present the issues, but we had a good conversation today. You know, we talked a lot this morning about how you know, something happened in 9/11, and all of us know that. And the meanings of that event, that tragic, terrible event that happened with the explosion of at the World Trade Center, with the destruction of the Twin Towers, the meanings of that tragic event have really been completely appropriated by a leadership that is bent on military conquest. And so the discussions about security, the Patriot Act, the kind of return of McCarthyism that you're talking about, in many ways I see as strategies that appear to be deployed in response to the great security risk threat that we're all experiencing, but in fact are part of another agenda. And they also, in many ways, are a distraction from the struggles that people are having around the world here, whether they're economic struggles, political struggles. So we're seeing yet again a reframing of history. We're seeing a reframing of contemporary reality. We're seeing the manipulation of language. I think our president no longer wants to talk about global warming. He wants to call it climate change. He says that asbestos lawsuits are frivolous, which basically disregards the experience of whole communities that are struggling with the legacy, with, you know, a 100-year industrial legacy, with corporations which have poisoned and contaminated their communities with asbestos. I think people have to reassert what they know, and they have to reassert it in terms that that are true and valid and can be tested by our collective experience and can be used to confront a militaristic and repressive national agenda, which we don't accept. But this is a long process, and it requires a lot of work on all of our parts. In Centralia, I don't think I could speak about about Centralia in relationship to the Patriot Act specifically. I can speak about it in relationship to the war in Iraq. When the war started, there's a gallant small group of anti-war activists that maintains a vigil in front of the statue, in front of the mural, outside the public library, every single Saturday at noon. And for the first 2, 3, 4 months of their vigil, they were booed, they were cursed, they were spat upon. People rode by in cars and opened their windows and said terrible things and then drove off. People pulled up in pickups and blocked their view so they couldn't be seen from the street. Their leaflets were torn up. It wasn't an unexpected experience. Centralia is known as a conservative political community. But it was challenging and it was difficult for people to maintain their resolve and dignity in the face of that. Now, when you go to that vigil, Centralia residents stop and talk, because I think people can see that the official rationale for the war is falling apart, that we're not winning the war, that we can't win a war against a whole population, that we're not actually bringing democracy to Iraq, that there's something else going on. So people are starting to think and starting to question.
And I want to thank you for your time.
Well, I really appreciate having had the opportunity to talk with you all, and I'm looking forward to my visit as well.
Wonderful, and good luck with the further process in the making of this film and further projects. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Free Radio.
Thanks. I'll keep you posted. Bye now.
Okay, see you next weekend.